Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The First Amendment is back at the Supreme Court in what could be a landmark case about whether government can coerce social media platforms to take down content that politicians don't like. Plus, can public officials block comments they don't like on their personal social media pages? The Supreme Court says no, unanimously, at least regarding most such attempts by politicians. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal Opinion Pages, and I'm here with my colleagues Kyle Peterson and Alicia Finley, both of whom write about the Supreme Court for us and, being journalists, care about the First Amendment, as all Americans do. Well, at least outside of academia. Let's start with today's big case, Murthy versus Missouri, which concerns government's efforts to force Facebook and other platforms to take down posts that criticize the government policies on COVID, things like vaccine mandates, mask mandates, and whatnot. These emails were exposed by the Missouri Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, who is now a U.S. Senator, and have been turned into a case with some states and the individuals whose posts were taken down suing. This has now reached the Supreme Court. Alicia, what were these government officials doing when they communicated with these social media platforms like Facebook?
Well, there are many government officials involved here, many different agencies, everything from the CDC to the DHS and the FBI. The core of their arguments in this case involve what some of the White House officials who actually weren't at the agencies were actually just, you know, advisors to President Biden on COVID affairs and digital strategy and outreach, that they asked these companies to take down posts involving vaccine misinformation, which was incredibly broad. There are some other allegations of FBI and DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, asked the companies also to remove posts involving election interference, but those are really not striking at the heart of this case.
Okay, so those were the interventions by government. Let's listen to Justice Samuel Alito at today's oral argument describe how he sees this.
Mr. Fletcher, when I read all of the emails exchanged between the White House and other federal officials and Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms, and I see that the White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners, we're on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away. When they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings. There is constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings. And they suggest, why don't you? They suggest rules that should be applied, and why don't you tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over? And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be?
Well, I know what my reaction would be. Thank you for your kind consideration, but park it. You know, they can't do anything to me other than go to my boss and try to get me fired, I suppose, or something like that. But they really did go beyond just lobbying, Alicia, here. There was threats involved, were there not?
Well, there were very public threats in terms of Jen Psaki, who was the White House press secretary at the time. And she raised the issue of, well, you know, these companies are subject to Section 230 liability, and there could be legal consequences. Section 230
protections. Section 230 offers liability protection for companies. And there was a kind of implicit threat that that could be taken away.
Right. And this actually public statements. I mean, the president himself went out in July, I think 2021, and said, well, Facebook is killing people. Now, he kind of walked that back and said, well, that's not actually what I meant. But there was a lot of, you guys are going to be held accountable. And they said in the email exchanges between White House officials and various agency officials that they could be blamed and held accountable for what is on their platforms.
Kyle, the government response here is interesting. It basically says, hey, look, we were just exercising our free speech rights. The government can have all kinds of points of view about things. And we were just saying, here's what we think. And that's really not crossing any First Amendment line. What do you think of that?
Well, in some cases, I think it's true, because what is difficult about this case is it covers a whole wide range of conduct. So there are examples in the record of these social sites on their own coming to, for example, the CDC and saying, here are some of the claims about vaccines or about COVID that we're seeing. Can you tell us whether these claims are true or not? And then the CDC responds. And I think that looks pretty routine to me. There's an example of somebody at the White House flagging an Instagram user. The username is Anthony Fauci Official. And the White House says, any way we can get this pulled down, it is not actually one of ours. Again, I think that looks pretty non-coercive. And I think that coercion is the test here that the Supreme Court is potentially looking at, because there are examples, both with social media and with the regular press, newspapers, and so forth, where the government will make its opinions known, will call up reporters. It was funny, after Justice Alito, that clip that you just played, Justice Kavanaugh came back and said, well, are there not examples where public information officers or press secretaries call up reporters and make clear that the government is unhappy about something, or it thinks that some reporting is going to jeopardize a secret agent, for example, overseas. And that does happen. But what's different here is this club, as Justice Alito called it, that the government has in this Section 230 immunity. And to the extent that even if it's not a clear threat, even if it's an implicit threat, that there's a business model here that these social companies have, and if they don't play ball, then it's potentially at risk. I think that is what is the real problem here.
Let me just elaborate on what Justice Kavanaugh said. He said it's not uncommon for government officials to protest an upcoming story on surveillance or detention policy and say, you know, if you run that, it's going to harm the war effort and put Americans at risk, end quote. But then he went on to basically make the distinction, I think, Alicia, that this kind of conversation, which is relatively routine with government officials, and Lord knows I've had my share of discussion with government officials of things they don't like. But when it gets into coercion and threats, is that the line here? Do you agree with Kyle on that?
Right. But it's also, where do you draw this line? And how do you distinguish the line? Because it can kind of be blurry in some cases, like the example you mentioned, that can actually sound like a threat. Well, if you don't do this, there are going to be national security implications. But the problem is that the government, at least in that case, doesn't really wield a lot of authority or power to punish newspapers if they don't comply with these demands, while they do with the tech platforms. And one of the cases that the Fifth Circuit, which ruled for the plaintiffs, cited was the Bantam Books case, which was back in the 1960s. Rhode Island set up a commission to actually enforce morality in books to protect children. It's hard to even believe nowadays that liberal state would do that, but it did. This case is really important or relevant because what happened there was that when the commission went around to a lot of bookstores and distributors and demanded their cooperation in removing the books. And then police ended up following up with the retailers to ensure that they complied. And the commission, while it said that, well, we were just engaging basically in government-protected speech, we were just encouraging the booksellers to remove it. But the Supreme Court of that case actually ruled that, well, no, the government had crossed the line. And if you looked at actually the tone of their hectoring and the authority to punish these book retailers, that's where you draw the line. And then because they were essentially phrased as orders, which is essentially what the Biden administration and Biden team's communications with the platforms were, that's how you draw the line. But again, there are going to be probably various tests, and how do you distinguish that is really the thorny question for the court.
Well, one test for me would be if the police call to follow up on the counsel by the government official and say, are you going to do what we asked, sir? That would be one thing that gets very close to coercion, if not is outright coercion. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more on this issue of when government officials can tell social media platforms to take down posts when we come back.
AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/wallstreet. oracle.com/wallstreet.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Alicia Finley and Kyle Peterson. And Kyle, just to pursue the oral argument a little bit more, let's listen to Justice Elena Kagan with her questions about when the government officials might very much want to ask a social media platform to take down a post.
These platforms, they're compilers of speech. And some part of the government, let's call it part of the law enforcement arm of the government, says, you might not realize it, but you are hosting a lot of terrorist speech, which is going to increase the chances that there's going to be some terrible harm that's going to take place. And we want to give you this information. We want to try to persuade you to take it down. The government can't do that?
The government can absolutely do that, Justice Kagan.
They're asking them to take down the speech.
Terrorist activity, criminal activity that is not protected speech, absolutely, the government can inform
Much of it might be protected speech. I mean, terrorists engage in, things that come under the First Amendment. I mean, let's say they're just recruiting people for their organizations.
Your Honor, if it's First Amendment speech, protected speech, then I think we're in an entirely different world.
Kyle, what do you make of that distinction, that lawyer for the states there, basically making the argument that if it's unprotected speech, then they can urge us to take it down? Is that the line here, or is it the coercion line that we talked about earlier?
I think it's the coercion line, because I think there are all sorts of examples of speech that is protected by the First Amendment that these platforms, again, of their own behest, have decided that they don't want to disseminate. And a lot of what makes this difficult is a lot of these examples are government officials or people within the bureaucracy in these agencies flagging things to Facebook or Twitter and saying, would you please take a look at this? We think that this is a violation of your terms of service. And I find it hard, again, to see how that crosses any sort of coercion line. What the government is doing is seeing things that bubble up. For example, there was an agency that was collecting reports from local elections offices about election misinformation and then forwarding them over to Facebook and Twitter to take a look at. Again, I don't think that crosses the coercion line. I think that coercion is the test. And Alicia's right, though. It is how you define and how you draw that line specifically. So the guy representing the U.S. government from the Solicitor General's office, in one of these examples we've already discussed, when Biden comes out and publicly says these platforms, this misinformation is killing people. I mean, he's arguing to the Supreme Court that that's not coercion. That is a public statement by the head of the executive branch from the bully pulpit, and it's not tied to any specific claim of changing Section 230 or taking any sort of retaliatory action against these social sites. He's saying that the people in the executive branch, they don't have power to change 230 on their own. They're not legislators, so they can't really be coercive in that regard. And I don't know that I buy that. I don't know that a majority of the Supreme Court is going to buy that. It sounds a little bit like, nice social site you have here. It'd be a shame if something broke the business model.
I just want to be clear here, Kyle. Your argument is that what Biden said does carry implications of coercion.
I don't know. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I can see a president, again, saying about a report in a mainstream newspaper. That report is going to put at risk our overseas sources and could end up killing American agents. And again, because the government does not have the kind of control over newspaper business models that it does over these social sites, I have a hard time thinking that that kind of statement by a president would be found coercive and a violation of the First Amendment. And so we may get some sort of test from the Supreme Court that will take some working out and be context specific. Another example that comes to mind is, what if it's a state agent or somebody in a local government office, a local election office, or a local public health office, and they're having these sorts of interactions with these agencies and saying, we're getting all sorts of claims about this measles outbreak, and Facebook, you got to help us because there's all sorts of false information going around. Those local officials certainly don't have the same kind of coercive power that somebody in the federal government does.
Interesting. Alicia, there was another question question raised at the oral argument, this one by the Chief Justice John Roberts. He asked the question, well, often the government doesn't speak with one voice. You might have the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, taking one position on an issue, but the Army Corps of Engineers taking another. And when you have the potential in government, which you often do, about different parts of the government having different views, he asked if that didn't diminish the potential for coercion. What do you think?
Well, I think the problem in this case, at least as applied, is that the White House and all the agencies seem to have the same view, and they seem to try to enforce it, impose it on the social media companies. Now, I'm just going to hark back to the Bantam Books example, and one of the standards it set for determining the coercion was not just the tone and phrasing, but also the legal authority and the potential to use that authority. And why that is relevant is that these agencies do, I mean, you mentioned the EPA, that which has, I mean, obviously it's not really involved in this case in particular.
No, just an illustrative question.
Right. But these agencies have tremendous power over companies and businesses. And even if they don't necessarily always use them, there's always the implicit threat that they could use them. And which is why, by the way, the companies are often afraid to sue their regulator, is because of the potential for retribution. And so you often instead get industry groups challenging rules rather than individual businesses.
Almost all the time, that's what they do. Companies defer to their industry groups. But I think what Roberts was getting at is this question of how do you draw a general rule here that would guide governments and lower courts about what they can and cannot do. In this case, I agree with you. There's a unanimity about the government pressure and the positions. All right, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we'll tell you what we expect the court to do in this case, and also talk a little bit about an opinion that came down from the court last Friday about when politicians can block critics on their social media sites when we come back.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here with Kyle Peterson and Alicia Finley. So this is a pretty speech-friendly court, First Amendment-friendly court. Where do you think it's going to come down on this Murthy versus Missouri case?
My guess is that they'll come up with a test that is broader than the federal government and the Solicitor General's office is arguing for, but perhaps not as broad as the injunctions in the lower courts that were issued that are now being presented to the Supreme Court. Just to follow up, I mean, that argument that the Solicitor General's office was making, that if you're in the executive branch, you have no power over 230. So how could you possibly coerce a social media site with regard to 230? I don't buy that. And I don't think the justices are going to buy that either, because if you're a senior official in the White House, you have a huge ability to set the agenda in Washington. And so I think some of this stuff that you're seeing in the record in this case is going to be deemed coercive. And it is worrying. I mean, there's an email from somebody at Meta to Surgeon General's office saying, our teams met today to better understand the scope of what the White House expects from us on misinformation going forward. And I think it will be hard for the Supreme Court not to find things like that and the context of that as coercive, just given the pressure that those platforms were under.
Alicia, I agree with that. I think that the Bantam Books precedent that you cited is going to be compelling in this case. And I think plaintiffs will win. What do you think?
I agree. And just one other point on this, I think you need to consider all these statements in context. And that was actually in the second case that the Supreme Court is hearing on Monday involving New York state officials basically jawboning banks. The important ruling that the district court made in that case was you need to consider all these comments or threats in the broader context. So even if an individual comment alone isn't considered coercive, when you consider the broader context, their basically political campaign is.
So if there's a continuing barrage of comments and threats and regulator statements, that is the context that has to be considered here. All right, there's another case that the Supreme Court made a decision on Friday, 9-0, which was written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And the decision was concerned as a couple of cases when the politicians can block social media critics, social media commenters on their sites. The plaintiff said they can't do that. That's a violation of their First Amendment rights. The public official said, oh, no, this is just my personal site. I wasn't speaking for the government. Where did the court come out here?
Right. So on both cases, they didn't clearly decide, but they essentially set forth a standard which rejected the argument that any public official couldn't bar constituents from following or posting on their personal account. Now, what was helpful, at least in my view, is that the Supreme Court laid out actually a new kind of test and a standard for determining when maybe local officials are actually posting in their private capacity or public capacity. Because in a lot of examples, you have government officials, politicians who use private accounts, AOC, Donald Trump actually, who use their private accounts to post about government jobs and government affairs. But the court helpfully ruled that that is not state action and that doesn't mean they de facto become public forums.
Just so I understand here, Alicia, does this mean so Donald Trump posts in his personal site on Truth Social and says, I'm going to slap 100% tariff on any cars coming into the country. And I decide to say as a critic, post, that's outrageous, Mr. President. I think it's a terrible policy. He can block me.
Right. At least under the standard that the Supreme Court laid out, because government officials do have free speech rights too, and they can express themselves and express their views on matters. So if Donald Trump was president right now, it technically wouldn't apply to him, this court ruling wouldn't apply to him. But if he were president and made that statement, yes, he could.
What? He could block me?
He could block and block the post.
Even though he's president.
Well, it's partly a personal account, but he doesn't have the actual authority to speak on the state's behalf with this account. And he's not purporting to exercise that authority, or at least in my view, when he's speaking on social media, he's expressing his personal views.
All right. So when can public officials not block critics?
Well, one is when they actually have an official account. So if this is an official government account, they cannot. And there are a lot of official government accounts, right?
Right. Sure.
But also when they are actually say that they're speaking on the government's behalf and they have the actual authority to do so.
All right, let me keep going here. So if you're a city council member and you have the power to obviously oversee a city budget or a city regulation or something, at least you can cast a vote, and I lambaste you for that vote on social media, and it's your personal Facebook account, but you often use that personal Facebook account to comment on public affairs or on different rules. What's the line there?
Well, I think as the Justice Barrett noted in the opinion, that these are necessarily fact-intensive inquiries. And you have to consider the fact that there are a variety of different and rapidly changing platforms. And so each functions differently. And you have to consider, again, like we were talking about, the broader context and what exactly the post. And some of these are very going to be hard to decide cases. But you need to consider that an official does not necessarily purport to exercise his authority simply by posting on a matter within it. So just because he expresses an opinion about the city council vote doesn't mean he's actually exercising his authority.
Boy, it sounds to me like this is a pretty squishy line that courts are going to have a hard time figuring out when public officials cross that line. Is this really a victory for the First Amendment, or is this a victory for public officials being able to slap down critics?
Well, I think it's a lot clearer than the previous standard that the Ninth Circuit had set. That was an appearance and content standard, which would have turned basically most private accounts into de facto public forums and expanded what is considered state action very broadly. But for people who actually care about the First Amendment, I don't think we really want to be turning all kinds of private accounts into public forums and deeming them government forums.
Mm-hmm. Kyle, you have a view on this?
Yeah, I mean, one salutary effect of this may be to help clarify for those public officials. So the city manager in this case did not have his account designated either personal or official. And so now there is a clear test from the Supreme Court. And if you're a local official and you don't want to be taken into court and sued over your use of Facebook, you can have a personal account and you can have an official account. And you got to keep that stuff separate. Again, here is from the syllabus of the court ruling. It says, a post that expressly invokes state authority to make an announcement not available elsewhere is official, while a post that merely repeats or shares otherwise available information is more likely personal. So the way I read that is, even if it's your personal account, or if it's not designated either personal or official, if you start doing city business on that account, that post then is liable if you start blocking people on it, because you can't block people from government business. And so one result of this might actually be fewer cases along these lines if it encourages these local, state, federal officials to keep their business in one place and their personal lives in another place.
All right. So it's going to be interesting to see how this is interpreted. I don't know how well this test will hold up, but I take Alicia's point that it's at least clearer than what we had before. All right. Thank you, Alicia. Thank you, Kyle. We'll see what the Supreme Court does this term on these First Amendment cases. This could be a blockbuster term for First Amendment. We appreciate our audience listening. We're here every day on Potomac Watch. Hope you're here tomorrow as well. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.